Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm here with my co-host Robin Martinez. So welcome, Robin.
Hi, Joyce. It's good to be here.
Thanks. It's great to be with you, too. And we have a special guest with us today that we're going to bring on in just one moment. Leslie Bennett is the new state ambassador for the National Organization for Rare Disorders, called NORD. We'll probably call it NORD in this conversation. And NORD is a national organization with sister organizations around the world that worries about rare diseases, anything that affects fewer than 1 in 100 people in the United States is considered to be rare. And some conditions are more rare than others, but what we all share is the challenges of finding a doctor who ever heard of it, finding anybody who knows how to help you. And so as those of you who listen to this show on a regular basis know that finding it, the diagnostic journey that goes along with a rare disease is something that's common to all people who are dealing with rare disorders, which altogether, when you put all those rare disorders together, is about 10% of the population. So one person in 10 in the United States is dealing with some rare disease. And Leslie is not only part of that community of people, but also part of the solution, trying to help people with rare disorders. So welcome, Leslie Bennett.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be on the show.
Thank you.
And, yeah, all the unique challenges we do face. And it affects about 10% of the population, but it can affect about up to 25% of the population when you figure in parents, grandparents, and, you know, aunts, uncles, siblings. And it does have a great emotional and financial impact on all of us. So thank you for having me.
Yes. I'm always amazed when you say some rare disease name, someone will say, oh, I know someone with that.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, how rare are these rare diseases then? But I think word gets around more now than it did in the past. In the 50s, people didn't talk the way they do today
about their own situation. In large part, that's thanks to NORD. Nationally, they started drawing awareness to rare and orphan diseases to try and, you know, promote drugs. So they've started educating us nationally. We're now going in and doing it on a state level, so that really helps. There's over 7,000 rare diseases that have been identified. Some of them will affect up to 200,000 people in the United States. Others will affect less than 100 people worldwide. So it's a huge problem. And like Joyce referred to, it's very difficult. There's no one center that we can go to. With that many disorders, there's no one center that can specialize in everything. So,
right, and there's no doctor who can know all the possibilities and be
right.
a diagnostician for everything.
Right. So that's been our difficulty. There's a handful of centers around the United States that can help. Most of them are pediatric. More than half of all rare disease patients are children. Many of them will not survive their third to fifth birthday. So, and it becomes, you know, very difficult for parents to just even manage their everyday life. So these are a lot of the challenges that we face.
Right. So you mentioned that NORD is getting into some legislative challenges in Connecticut. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's not just Connecticut. It's around the country. We all we face the same thing that a lot of chronic disease patients face. We get hit very hard nowadays with huge out-of-pocket payments for a lot of these drugs. They're specialty tier. So automatically you're no longer paying just a copay, you're paying a percentage of the drug. And many of the drugs that are used to treat these rare diseases and rare cancers are extremely expensive. So it's just a huge financial burden. Plus, things like step therapies. I mean, why, when you change insurers, do you have to keep going through the using medications that you know won't work in order to prove the insurer that you can go on to the next step? I mean, those are all things that are challenges, not just for us. It's for anybody with a chronic illness. So NORD realized that a couple years ago and started getting involved in state legislation in state issues, and they'll be anything from school issues that are, you know, facing these children to a lot of the medication issues that face all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the hope that we're doing. And this rare disease task force that we're trying to get together will, we're trying to help both the legislature and the Department of Public Health, Department of Developmental Services, children and families with issues related to rare diseases. A lot of parents with rare diseases will come in and you'll go to an emergency room, for instance, and the doctor never will have heard of your disease and starts accusing the parents of making up symptoms or making up the child's illness, and that's not the case at all. So we run into a lot of those issues.
Right, and so much of this is regulated by the states. It's not central. So instead of fighting the battle one time, you have to fight it 50 times.
Yeah. It, medical foods, that's a huge issue for us. PKU is pretty, medical food for PKU is pretty much covered by all states, but not for a lot of the other disorders. So those are issues that we try to work on and explain to legislatures why it's better to cover the medical food rather than have these patients go into the hospital constantly. And those are issues that all of us.
So children who are born with different metabolic disorders often can be helped by these, as you say, medical foods that are specially compounded to meet their requirements. And but they're not cheap. And they're not like on every grocery store shelf. You have to get them sometimes by prescription or certainly by sending away for them.
Yeah.
Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's like my daughter has a she has a disorder where she can't break down protein, so she ends up being sensitized. And for years, we had to order Neocate, which is an elemental formula hypoallergenic. And it was not covered for a long time. Fortunately, the state of Connecticut was one of the first to step in and cover it for us, but they only cover it up to age 13. And a lot of these children will require it for a lifetime. So those are issues that we have to talk to people. And it's not that we want the entire thing paid for. It's just that there has to be some break for us to pay like what you'd normally pay for regular formula or something like that, where we're not getting hit. I mean, these cans run into $100 per can for some of them, and that lasts for a couple of days. Yeah, that's the problem. You know, a regular formula can, you can walk in and you pay under $20 for it, whereas we're paying five times that expense, and, you know, only lasts for a couple of days. So it adds up tremendously. Some of these parents are And even with the caps through ACA, a lot of these things, when it's specialty tier or some of these other medical foods, it doesn't count against the cap. So we're spending the $10,000 just to meet the cap payments plus the extra expenses of all the foods or the medications that a child or young adult might need. And it adds up after a while. So a lot of these parents end up going on welfare, or the children get on to some sort of insurance service through the state, and the state ends up picking the costs up. So it affects all of us in the long run. You know, they're all things that we have to think about, especially in light of the budget crisis that we're having here in Connecticut. So.
Right, and budget crisis
factors
in many places,
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, our health care costs are getting crazy at some point. And we have to figure out, you know, the best ways to spend our money a lot of times. And with these patients that are requiring specialty foods, when they can't afford them, what happens? They go into the hospital. Now, the last time my daughter was in the hospital, for instance, for a week, it cost over $21,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And, yeah, and for a lot of that would cover the costs of most of these patients' formulas or specialty foods in 1 year. So in a one-week hospitalization, they've covered it. And if we don't start covering the costs of these formulas, they end up in the hospital four and five times. So the cost that the state ends up paying through Medicaid a lot of times can be 5 to 10 times higher than the cost of covering the formula right to begin with.
Right.
So they're all things
to mention,
that you have to...
Yeah, not to mention the wear and tear on the child's long-term health, because if they go into crisis and have these repeated hospitalizations, it weakens their stamina, it weakens their long-term health.
Well, it weakens the health of the entire family because a lot of times you'll have a mother or father there with the child the entire time, you know, and just the wear and tear on the emotional drain on the family is just enormous. So it it adds up, and the parents end up getting sick then too. So it's a huge toll, and there are things that we're hoping that the Rare Disease Task Force here in Connecticut can explain to the legislature, explain to schools, explain to employers the problems that these families face, and there are ways that we can start to address some of these issues. So that's what we're hoping to do anyway here in Connecticut.
That's great. Yeah, one of the things that I sometimes would hear from people is, you know, if these diseases are so rare, I mean, why do we need to worry so much about them? You know, let those people take care of themselves. And why is this important to the public at large? And one of them is the financial issue, of course, that you just mentioned. If we if we don't deal with it proactively, we wind up paying more to clean up the mess. But in addition to that, I think it's important for people to realize that these rare diseases are helping us understand the more common diseases. So
basically,
for example, you know, when they want to study a disease, they create a knockout mouse. You know, they create a mouse that doesn't have the gene that they're interested in looking at. But these people with rare diseases are essentially, if you will, the white mice. They're walking around without this gene, and you can learn a lot from what happens without this gene just by studying the population of people who were born that way.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, that's how I think it was Lipitor was discovered. It was originally a drug that was developed for a rare cholesterol disorder, and then they realized that it could do wonders for the general population in lowering cholesterol levels. So these are basically fundamental diseases. A lot of them only affect one, you know, gene variant, so they can help us learn about things that affect anything from heart disease to diabetes, or, you know, just even Alzheimer's. So, I mean, they really do, the research on these really does help all of us in the long run. And that's what they're learning, you know, an awful lot about. But in general, these diseases kind of show us the way to manage, a lot of times, to manage our own healthcare system, because we look at these kids, younger children especially, and if we're proactive in dealing things like getting their formula, making sure they have medications, having the follow-up, we can keep them out of the hospital, and that's how we lower the healthcare costs. So there's a lot to be learned from the rare disease community, I think, in the way we manage our medicine and our research as well. So
you've put yourself out there as an advocate for not only your daughter's condition, but for other rare diseases. And what kinds of organizations have you worked with to be the patient voice?
Well, I currently work with NORD. I also work with the Rare Disease Legislative Advocates, and I work with the National Patient Advocate Foundation, which deals with patients with chronic diseases, mostly cancer, but a lot of cancers themselves are rare. And my father died of a rare brain cancer, which is how I wound up working with them. My background is also in laboratory science and medical research. Years ago, I was involved in research mostly in cancer support. So when my daughter was born, my husband and I were very lucky. At the time, he was working for U.S. Surgical. He was a director at U.S. Surgical. And my background, we knew physicians all across the country. So when our daughter was born, we had access to the best medical care possible. And a lot of the people that you try to get in to see with these patients with rare disease, the only way you can get in to see them is a referral, and it's not just a referral from your pediatrician. It has to be a referral from a specialist. So they become even more rare and harder to find. But in our case, we were very lucky, and then I started advocating when I realized that a lot of parents had no idea what to do or who to call. And initially, I started out helping parents locate the medical care they needed, and then a few years ago, I realized that to make changes that were needed for a lot of these patients, we had to get involved, or I had to get involved, in working on with the legislatures, either in states or down with Congress. And that's how I ended up working with these the major three organizations, but I've also worked with a lot of smaller groups and local groups, like the local epilepsy groups here in Connecticut. Some of the allergy groups, my daughter, because she can't break down protein and become sensitive, develop food allergies. And so I've worked with several of the allergy groups around. And, and just a number of other smaller groups. And I find sometimes I'm approached by groups that I've never even heard of their disorder before, and we start talking. But the problem is all of rare disease patients face the same issues publicly. It's, find access to medical care, access to services that we need. And it's not just medical services. There's a lot of home care services or home services that they need, schooling services, and supports just to get around. And these disorders range from things like in my daughter's case that are debilitating and life-threatening all the time to mild things. Some of the patients with mitochondrial diseases, for instance, you wouldn't know that they had a disorder until they hit a crisis, and that mm-hmm. becomes an issue too at school. One of my another advocate in the state who was going to be on the task force, her son almost died when the school did not follow his plan for a crisis, and he wound up in the hospital. So that's why she adamantly advocates in the state here too. There are a lot of issues just in life that face us all, and we're a little bit different. Where, as my daughter's surgeon at Boston Children's refers to my daughter, she's a one-off. So
that's
normal
what
things
I was
that
going to ask you about.
Yeah.
Now that we're getting so deep into genomics and finding more and more interesting things about it, mm-hmm. I think we're going to find more and more patients who have something that kind of looks like something else, but it isn't mm-hmm. because the genetic mutation is different. And
right.
we're going to find a lot of individual cases that are syndromes that have never been seen before or named. They were just
right.
lumped in the past with something else.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing that, especially like in the autism spectrum disorder group. You've seen them go through and refine it and try and get more and more refined as to what is true autism. But then now we have a whole group of children who no longer have a diagnosis. And they obviously have something wrong. So we're just not quite there yet genetically, but you're right. A lot of things are starting to show up that we've never seen before. The some of the glycosylation disorders, for instance, we really didn't know about them years ago, and now all of a sudden there's almost one being discovered every other month, it seems like.
What kind of disorders?
Glycosylation disorders. There are disorders in the glycosylation pathway, where a lot of times it's not just a single mutation, there may be a couple mutations. And individually, the single mutations don't look like they would cause a problem, but when they're combined with another mutation, the results can be devastating. I think it's NGL.
This is
NGLY1.
Glycolysis pathway.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So it mm-hmm. has to do with the way sugars are processed in the cell?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And we're seeing that. Marshall Summer is a geneticist down at Washington National, and he's aware that it used to be that most of the disorders were classified as a SNP, a single, mutation that they would see. But now all of a sudden they're seeing that patients will have, especially the ones that have been very difficult to diagnose, will have more than one mutation. And that's kind of how they learned about the glycosylation disorders. And there's a number of others that are starting to show up now. So
right.
it's genetics. We're really kind of at the tip of the iceberg with all of this.
Yeah.
Right. But even common things like breast cancer, we're realizing breast mm-hmm. cancer is not just one problem. It's actually multiple problems with slightly different cellular traits that are wrong. So mm-hmm. that one group of people may respond very well to one drug, but another group of people also with breast cancer are not going to respond to that drug properly.
Right.
And so until we get down to that cellular level and understand what particular mutation is operating here, we really can't even assign the right drug.
Yeah, and that's a real difficult. Plus, we're also running into, I know in some of the rare blood cancers, for instance, drugs that they thought were an absolute cure for like a particular form of leukemia, all of a sudden the leukemia mutates and the drug no longer fully works.
Right.
So these are all
right.
things that are happening. But we're learning so much from all of this. And, you know, is there one cure or anything? No, but I think there's a lot of things out there that we can, you know, use to help a lot of these patients. And, the genetics is just changing by the minute. I don't see how physicians can keep up, quite honestly.
Right.
And
that's why it's so important for patients and their parents and their advocates to be really deeply informed about a specialty type of disease, because
mm-hmm.
they can learn more about one disease. They're only focused on that one disease and maybe its relatives,
right.
whereas the doctor has to handle all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so a patient can come in and say, have you seen this clinical trial? What do you think about this approach to treatment? I think we ought to try, and doctors are now getting accustomed to patients saying things like this. And, of course, a lot of patients go in and say dumb things like, give me an antibiotic for my cold.
Oh, I know.
But a lot of patients go in and say brilliant things, and doctors find out all sorts of stuff. I know a patient who received a drug that nobody thought would work on his cancer, and it did.
And now, for
that kind of cancer, yeah, it worked. Temporarily.
And it's wonderful that that patient found a doctor who would listen and work with him.
Right.
Because a lot of times
right.
they're intimidated and they don't. But that's, I think, especially we're running into a lot of younger physicians who are more willing, at least, to work and listen to patients, because that's the key. Each patient will react differently to a medication, and that's part of the key, is listening to that patient. Sometimes it looks like the drug should work, but it doesn't for that patient. For some reason, we'll probably never fully understand, but epigenetics enters into it also.
Right.
So there are so many factors that enter into all these things that it really is key to listen to the patients. 10 years ago, it started in Europe with one of the sister organizations, but they started having a Rare Disease Day. It is the last day in February. It'll be February 29th this year, which is a Monday. And we have a meeting, and we end up going, for the last, I think, 9 years, we've been going to the National Institutes of Health. And they really do an excellent job educating all the patients, patient advocates, and everyone else. And what they've stressed is learning as much as you possibly can about your disorder from the experts, so that if you end up going into the hospital, you can teach the doctors. And a lot of parents, especially with children with rare disorders, know more about their child's disorder and how their child reacts to everything than any physician ever will, because we end up keeping notebooks when our children have a crisis, when they react to anything, so that it can help the physicians and help us manage them better. And as a result, a lot of these patients with rare diseases are living much longer. We're running also into a problem right now, which I'm running into with my daughter, is we run into rare disease patients who were not expected to live, survive childhood, suddenly living into adulthood, and it's creating a huge problem across the country. The adult community is not ready. They've never seen these patients. They have no idea how to manage them. And now we have major academic pediatric centers bulging at the seams with these children, and they don't know what to do. So this is another issue.
The adult physicians have never dealt with this disease, and they're not prepared for it. So that the pediatrician winds up managing people who are 30, 40, 50 years old.
Mm-hmm. My daughter is in that group. She's 26, so now she has basically maxed out of the not totally. I mean, we're going through we tried to transition her to adult care from Boston Children's to Brigham and Women's, and we've hit a roadblock. And Children's is now mad at me because of the roadblock, but that's not the problem. That when we walked in to see we've seen three major specialists. I mean, just absolutely wonderful people. We walked in, they would all like to help, but it's all the same thing. Your daughter's the most complicated case I have ever seen. I have never managed a patient with an inborn error of metabolism so rare. You know, and I'm like, yeah. You know,
I've heard of cases where on the patient's chart in the hospital, someone will have written on the first page in big letters, "Listen to the mother."
Yes,
and
really,
as the patients become adults, you're going to see notes that say, "Listen to this patient."
The metabolic consortium. One of the things they do when they write up their metabolic, methods for handling or the metabolic emergency plans, the one thing they have right at the beginning is listen to the parents. They know
yes.
how the child will react, and they can tell you. You know, and that's key, and it's key with all of these patients. They are, like I said, my surgeon refers to Kelly as a one-off, and he listens every time I walk in. You know, what's her reaction to this? What's her reaction to that? And it is, and we end up keeping, you know, extensive lists, but if they listen, there's no worries about, it's a matter of working together. It's a partnership.
Yes.
I mean, it is a true partnership, and it has to be. But
we're
running into that more and more.
We're down to the last 4 minutes of the show.
Oh,
so
I'm sorry.
Let me just ask you one, not a brief question, but if we can bottle this a little bit. When parents come as advocates to an established organization, what do you expect from that organization? Do you expect them to create new programs for patients, or are you just interested in learning how they do things and being in their conversation?
Well, I think a lot of it is being in their conversation, learning how they do things, and then working together to create programs where they may be needed, where there's no other, organization addressing an issue. And that's the big thing, especially I think a lot of it is what we would expect from NERG is to help us educate physicians on some rare disorders or, you know, genetic issues that they may not have thought of. And it's really working together. We don't come demanding things unless there is something really, really wrong and we need help.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, we try to work with other organizations to, help raise awareness. It's awareness among patients. I think one of the first things that parents face is when a child is born and they have something that is a rare genetic condition, they're just devastated. They don't know where to go, where to get help,
right.
Where to get information. You know, just even the first step, I mean, a lot of them have no idea there's genetic counselors out there who may be able to help them or what programs across the country can help them. And, you know, that's the big thing. It's trying to develop programs where we can help those parents but also help the physicians understand what they need.
Right, and then
right.
we have the problem of people being in Tucson, and somebody says, you need to go to Boston.
Yeah, and how do we get them there? There are
right.
other organizations out there that can help with travel expenses and things like that. And I think we're also starting to move towards an area of telemedicine where some of these initial consultations can be done maybe over the phone before that patient has to go there and you absolutely know whether Boston can help, for instance, or not. And, I mean, sometimes it's not always Boston they have to go to. Sometimes it'll be a facility on the West Coast where the specialist is. Or in some cases, these disorders are so rare.
That's right.
One of my friends is having to go to Italy.
That's right. That's right. Leslie, this has been delightful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you
us.
Very much for including me. I really appreciate it. And thanks an awful lot.
Great.
Have a good day
right.
and have a happy holidays to both of you. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much. Robin,
bye-bye.
Any other final comments that you'd like to add?
This was fantastic. As always, I've learned something and I really enjoyed it.
Good. And a lot of what Leslie said about parents dealing with a newborn baby also applies to people with a brand new diagnosis of something like cancer. So, you know, all of this, it means that the patient needs to be as empowered as possible and hopefully create a good constructive conversation with all the providers. So thanks, everybody, for being with us, and special thanks to Leslie for being with us. And we hope that you'll be with us again next week. So be well and be a powerful patient. Take good care.